From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on March 13th when the city of Rochester announced that Cedric Alexander was coming back. Alexander had served as Rochester's interim police chief in 2005, had a long career in law enforcement, and here's how the Democrat and Chronicle characterized the announcement in March. Quote, "The man who Lovely Warren originally wanted for police chief will become her deputy mayor. And if Monday was any indication, chief surrogate for her re-election campaign," end quote. Well, Mayor Warren was clearly thrilled to have him back, saying he has a heart and a passion for Rochester. And she said his connections to this community will serve him well in the job. Earlier this week, we heard from City Hall. They got in touch with us. They said he's finally actually officially started work, and the mayor's State of the City address was earlier this week. They said, "You want to talk about various issues with the new deputy mayor?" And we said, "Of course. Cedric Alexander's my guest for the hour. The deputy mayor now, who's on day four now? Is this
day four?
Day four,
Evan, yeah.
So are you gonna cap out on me with this? I've only been here for 4 days all the hour. We're not going to be able to talk about
it. Well,
anything.
I probably will insert it at certain times when I find it to be relevant.
Okay, well, to be fair here, we're going to touch on a range of issues. I think we're going to focus a lot on police work, your career here, you know, where your career has taken you, how you see things now. I know very fairly that there are certain things you can and can't quite talk about yet, but let's just kind of back it up and say, was the Democrat and Chronicle right? Go back to 2013. Mayor Warren wanted you for the police chief job?
She did at that time, but of course, during that juncture in my career, in the beginning of her mayoral career, I had been in DeKalb County for about 6 months. So it certainly was a very attractive offer, but it was at that time for me the best decision to stay there. That's been 4 years ago now, roughly 4 years ago. And the opportunity that I spent there in DeKalb County, which is a suburb of metro Atlanta, huge county, 700,000 residents, roughly about 1,100 police officers, or at least that's what we were supposed to have had.
Sure.
And but at that time, it was, I think I made the best decision by staying there. But it's amazing how life comes back around. But I think the experience I had over the last 4 years really helped me tremendously to share in some very new experiences that just happened to occur. And I think things happen the way they supposed to, when they supposed to. And I think me being here now is a great opportunity for me, and certainly to be back in this city that I've always had a great affinity for ever since I came here in 1997 to do postgraduate study at the University of Rochester Medical Center. So I'm delighted to be home, and delighted to be back among people that I know and people I've continued to have relationships over the years, even when I was away.
Remind our listeners, when we say you came back, as you say, 1997 was your first foray into Rochester, but you grew up where?
In Pensacola, Florida. Grew up in Pensacola, policed in Florida very early in my career, in Tallahassee and Orlando, and then subsequently Miami, where I spent a number of years with the Miami-Dade Police Department. Decided in 92, Evan, I wanted to go back to school, and went back and pursued a doctorate in clinical psychology in one of the Ohio State schools, and got accepted into a postdoc fellowship here at the University of Rochester Medical Center in Family Psychology, trained for a year. And before that year was up, the university invited me to stay on faculty. And I was there for about 5 years. And about 2002, a former mayor, Bill Johnson, invited me into the police department. There was some challenging issues going on back during that time between police and community. And we were able to really affect some real positive changes and certainly build some morale inside that organization. And subsequent to that, I became chief and spent a short time as chief, and then went on down to Albany, where I spent a couple of years roughly with former Governor George Pataki as a deputy commissioner of criminal justice. And on from there, I went to Homeland Security, where I spent the next 5.5 years running the full operation there of federal security there at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. And had this desire to want a chief again, Evan. And so I applied to DeKalb back in 13 and accepted that position, was there for 4 years. And that really, this year, quite frankly, is the 40th year for me in the profession of law enforcement, in and out of law enforcement over them. Even when I was out, I was still very much in, if you will.
Why did you want a chief again?
Well, you know, it's just one of those things, man, where, you know, it's hard to explain. It's something that you have a passion for. And it was in my heart to have an opportunity to go back and chief again. I was very, very fortunate to be selected there in DeKalb, and particularly being an outsider. But it was a tremendous opportunity for me. And during those 4 years, a lot of great things happened along the way in my career that really helped me, and I hope has overall helped this country as well.
All right, so before we get back to police work and how you see that work in Rochester, how things perhaps have changed since you left and now you've come back here, I'm just curious, when were you in touch with Mayor Warren to really cement the fact that you could come back and take the deputy mayor position? Does this go back? I know she wanted you as police chief in 2013, but have you stayed in touch with her? When did that really kind of...
We stayed in touch over the years and stayed in touch with her, stayed in touch with a number of people here in the community I've come to know over the years. We just happened to have a conversation one day, going back some months, and she presented that opportunity to me. And considering the fact, here again, this marks the 40th year of my career, I had a great time being a police chief. I'll always be a psychologist. I'm still licensed here in the state of New York as a marriage and family therapist. And so for me, it was the end of one career in my life. And here's an opportunity to come back to a city that I know and love and where people know me and to serve in this role. And the timing, quite frankly, could not have been any more perfect. And I'm just very grateful of the opportunity to be able to do this.
And so as you come back, are you going to be focused on any particular area in helping Mayor Warren and her administration? Are you going to be doing a number of different things? How do you view your role?
Well, my role is this. As deputy mayor, I'm pretty much responsible, Evan, for the day-to-day operation of the city and whatever it is that the mayor feels that I need to be involved in. And certainly that's the role that I will play. So every aspect of city government, whether it's environmental services, whether it's fire, public safety, or whatever it is that it may happen to be, I'll be involved in working with those department heads, those commissioners of those respective areas who I've come to meet and have met over the course of this week, who are very talented people and who are very committed to this city growing and advancing. And as I get to know them, they get to know me. I'm looking forward to just continued opportunity to stay on this trajectory and this vision that the mayor has outlined for this city.
The Democrat and Chronicle reported, and I want to make sure we're clear on your role as deputy mayor, that you had said you plan to seek a clinical faculty position at the University of Rochester. And also, you know, you've taken on a role as an analyst with CNN that you may still be doing things like that. And is that stuff that you're going to continue to do, first of all, with CNN and also with the U of R? And could that distract you from your role in the city?
So let me put
sure.
some clarity to that.
Yep.
So when I was here, I was on faculty, even still when I was serving as chief. I have my appointment back at the university in the Department of Psychiatry, but Evan, all is going to evolve that upon occasion, they invite me over to do what we refer to as grand rounds in the medical center. So I might talk for an hour to a group of medical students or psychiatry residents about police and community, let's say, for an example. That would be pretty much the extent of my role as being on faculty.
So I won't be a
paid faculty member there teaching classes during the day and that type of thing. I think that got taken out of context, but certainly I'm affiliated with the university. The university is an outstanding institution that is certainly partnered with this city, and I'm very proud to be a part of that university, and when I will continue my appointment with them. But like I say, my role will be very limited, and also we will continue to communicate from my level with the university and its leadership about further partnering and things that we can do both with the university and with the city as well.
Talking to Rochester Deputy Mayor Cedric Alexander, who's on day four of the job after coming back at the request of Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren. And if you want to call the program with questions or comments, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. When we had the chance to sit down with the Deputy Mayor, I knew I wanted to talk about his work in policing, which we're going to get to in a moment. And of course, we're coming off the state of the city, and I wanted to talk about jobs numbers. Now, you may not be able to dig into this in detail, but I have to at least ask here. Mm-hmm. You know, the mayor made some claims about 30,000 jobs created or retained, mm-hmm. and talked about the record that she's laid out. Dave Andreatta and the Democrat and Chronicle tried to take apart those numbers as best he could with some detail and raise some questions about whether that's a real accurate representation of what the city has been able to do there. Have you been able to dig in those numbers? Is there anything you can share with us about those jobs numbers, and should we be able to trust those numbers?
Well, you know, I had an opportunity on my first day on the job when that I think the article came out the next day.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, I had an opportunity to read that editorial. And, you know, but here's the thing. The mayor in that reporter essentially saying the same thing, and I think what has to be further—
I don't think they would agree with that.
Well, let me finish.
Yeah.
But I think the important part is here is how those numbers were determined and how they got to those numbers. And I think that will be further articulated if it needs to be. But here is the important part, Evan, at the end of the day, is that she has created jobs in this community. Me coming back in this community, walking around, riding around this community, and I see brick and mortar that is coming up. I see people going to work. I see the mayor's plan and her vision to continue to create jobs in this community, that really has to be the focus, because we can always step back and we can find something negatively wrong with virtually anyone who's in a political position. I mean, that's what happens, comes with the territory, right? But the reality of it is, as my part of coming back here is because I truly believe in what she's doing. I truly believe in this city as a whole. I believe in her leadership, but also believe in the people that live here throughout this entire city and throughout this entire region, throughout this county, who I know who wholeheartedly, in the depths of their heart, want the very best for this city. And as we challenge ourselves to this numbers, to these numbers, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that she creates jobs, she's creating opportunities, not today, but going forward as well. And if we stay focused on the positive things that's going to come out of this administration continually, and as we think about going into the next 4 years of this administration, and we look around us and we see all the hope and the promise that is not just articulated in words, but it's actually being demonstrated. But for us to get there, Evan, we have to get there as a community. And that's very realistic, and I mean that very wholeheartedly. So, but to put some closure to that piece, if you will, it's important to focus on. It's important for me, being new here, coming in here in many ways with a fresh set of eyes of things that are going on around us, and not being marred with a lot of the other negative things that have happened. My focus is going to be positive. It's going to be looking forward. How do we reach the vision and the goals of, that the mayor has outlined? And how do we do that as a community at large? Because when we look across this great city, it's a very diverse community. In a community not just diverse in the obvious of race and gender, Evan, but it's diverse in a matter of thought and how we process information. We have a lot of young people, young millennials, who are moving into this community, who are asking great questions and who want to be part of something that's growing, something that has a potential to be very robust in terms of this community moving forward. That's Rochester 2017. That's the Rochester going forward. It's not the Rochester past, it's the Rochester future. And I think if we collectively, regardless of who we are, move forward with those types of ideas, we're going to be a greater community for it. Look, I've sat on both sides of the aisle, both with Republicans and Democrats. And I'll tell you this, having been involved in both parties, understanding that at the end of the day, who we are, we're just Americans who want the very best for our communities. We want jobs. We want good public safety. We want good education. In this city, like many other cities across this country, great large cities and smaller cities, we struggle with our own social issues. But the most important piece is that we're moving in a direction. The rest of the country is watching us as we watch other places across this country. A lot of cities are watching us. And I think we have an opportunity to role model, to continue to role model an American spirit that shows, regardless of what it is that we're confronted with, we're going to reach those goals together. And I just don't say that because I'm on your show. People out there in the community who know me, they know that I don't talk out of both sides of my mouth. And I'm just excited to be here. I'm very excited for the city. And I'm very excited to be part of this growth and this vision.
Now, before we move on to other issues, I'll tell our listeners, you know, if you want to get granular on the numbers, we'll do that on a different day. You know, we'll follow up. I think I know City Hall is willing to do that. And to some degree, you know, I will take Cedric's word that as early as you are in your job, if I asked you to get really granular on the numbers, is it 30,000? Is it 8,000? Is it 3,400? Probably, is it too early for you to really feel like you can get granular with us on the
No, I mean, I can't get granular with any of it, but here's what I can say to you is this, is that jobs are being created in this city, and how those numbers were determined, how they came to that, it will be a point that I think for a later show in which to be addressed.
But we should want it to be accurate, right?
Look, I mean, the point of it is, you know, if it's an issue to the community, if it's, it certainly is something that the mayor, I know, have the ability to address, and she will be the one to address it, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But here again, let's not lose focus because of that. Let's not lose focus of where we are presently. And as in because if we look around here again, Evan, we see construction, we see opportunities. We're listening to the opportunities are being created every day that's going to produce more jobs, more opportunity, more economic growth in this community. And we're just at the tip of the iceberg of this. That's where we are. And if so, so it becomes so important at the end of the day is that we focus on still what we're yet to do and opportunity that's in front of us. But if we get bogged down on any number, however great or small it may be, we lose focus of the fact we still got to continue to create jobs and opportunity and hope in a city that has a historic history to it, in a city that has survived and overcome a lot of its challenges.
All right, very good. We're talking to Deputy Mayor Cedric Alexander. We will follow up with the city on more of the details on the jobs numbers. I see a couple people waiting on the phones, but before we do that, let me just kind of go over a little bit of your police work and career. First of all, I don't know many or any police chiefs or former police chiefs who are also psychologists. How do you think that has informed your police work? Has it benefited you?
Well, it's benefited me tremendously, I think, in a great deal of ways. Actually, when I became a psychologist, I pretty much thought I was at the end of my law enforcement career, but later learned that I was just at the beginning of it. So when I had an opportunity at the invite of at that time, former Mayor Bill Johnson, to come in to take my law enforcement skill set along with my clinical training and help introduce at that time ways in which we could better begin to build relationships between police and community. And I'm going to tell you something. This community is so fortunate to have such a dynamic group of men and women in public safety, from fire to police. And let's not forget our 911 operators, because that's where it all begins with them, with that phone call and their ability to be professional and under sometimes of the most intense and stressful situations, take information and refer that information to the appropriate place, whether it's police or fire. And from there, you have men and women who are trained to respond to some of the most tragic situations, not just once a day, but sometimes all day. And so we're very, very fortunate in this community to have the leadership of a Chief Simonelli and his appointed staff, along with Chief Shriver there at Fire, and of course, John Merklinger over at 911. And I am so delighted to have an opportunity to work with them and to work alongside them at this point in time in America's history.
All right, let me grab a call on the subject of community policing. It comes from Kevin in Rochester. First up, go ahead, Kevin.
Hi, I'm a I'm a physician, Cedric, and we worked together when I was medical director at one of the methadone programs here. And
yes, sir.
You were at the medical center doing doing counseling before you got back into policing. And
yes, yes.
I really very much appreciated your work. Mike, I currently do my clinical work with Jordan Health at the site, Woodward site, which is on Genesee Street, mm-hmm. shares the Boys and Girls parking lot, is across the street from Wilson High School. And as you know, there was a horrific shooting there a few years ago. And, you know, there continued to be, you know, violence in the area, gang-related activity. Our health center has, you know, has unarmed security guards who walk around and get to know people, and really does a good job of, mm-hmm. of working with the community, getting to know people there, and helping to minimize the potential for conflict. My question is why can't the Rochester City Police do the same thing, and actually have officers, you know, do the beat, and get out there on Genesee Street, walk around and get to know people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I really think that would help a lot to really mitigate the violence and perhaps begin to avoid some of these shootings.
Right, and I appreciate the comments, and I certainly do understand them. I hear that all the time, and I think Rochester Police Department, just like many police departments across this country, certainly have made tremendous efforts in terms of extending themselves to build those relationships, to get out of those police cars when they have opportunities to do so, to walk and meet and talk to people. And certainly there are a number of programs such as Clergy on Patrol, which has been very positive and well-meaning in this community, where police and community and clergy walk those streets together. But on a daily basis, we also have to keep in mind, too, my friend, that these officers respond to a large number of calls for service of a great variety. And when they have the opportunities, they certainly do get out of those vehicles, I'm quite sure. But they also have to respond to emergency situations oftentimes, and that could be anywhere from a cat in a tree to a violent crime that's in process, in progress. But the city, and more recently, has gone to the five-section model, which has proven to be quite beneficial, in which it places officers back in those communities where they get to know people and people get to know them. And I think that model in and of itself is going to pay a huge dividends. But, you know, we always can use more officers, but we've come to be able to realize we have to work with what we have. But community policing is so essentially important, and all the literature will reflect and point to the fact that when you have good community policing, where you have police and community working together, it builds relationships, it builds community, and it reduces crime. And when you have challenges in those communities, even as the challenge you're talking about, sir, a couple of years ago, police and community able to come together and devise strategies and plans in which to move forward in hopes that that kind of thing don't happen again, or at least be in a position where we can help circumvent it. But this is a total effort. On parts of police and on the part of community in order to be able to get these things done.
All right, we'll pick up that thread after our only break of the hour. We're going to come back with the deputy mayor of the city of Rochester, Cedric Alexander, who is on his fourth day on the job after returning to Rochester at the request of Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren. He is a former Rochester police chief. He was the interim chief in 2005, 40 years in various capacities in law enforcement. And we'll take more of your calls and talk with him about more about police work here in Rochester and more on the other side of this break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Safe Haven airs tonight, a remarkable documentary from 1987 that tells the story of the only refugee help the United States gave to Jewish victims of the Holocaust in the 1940s. That camp, that base, was established at Fort Ontario in Oswego, 982 people. Their story going to be rebroadcast tonight, and we'll learn all about it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Cedric Alexander is our guest for the hour, the deputy mayor. And let me just ask you to kind of weigh in on some national issues that have been ongoing for a number of years now. I know you're working various states. These questions are not new to you, but I think it will be instructive for our listeners to hear. So first of all, do you think people of color are treated differently by police in this community?
In this community specifically, I think what you have in this community, as you have in many communities across this country, Evan, is that we're still working through a great deal of social issues. And it's not just the matter of race. It's also a matter, I think, in which it stems from a long history in which police, I think, in many ways have been used wrongly, going back to Jim Crow, when police were used to keep people segregated from each other, right? And what that did to police still plays itself out to this day. So anytime that you have a situation that involves a young person of color and a police officer, specifically if they're white, it tends to play itself out in a way that creates a great deal of concern and pause. And there certainly have been incidents that create concern and pause. We cannot deny that. But I think the work that is still yet to be done is much on a much greater issue, is at a much greater place. Because in as much as police over the last several years has been asked to train better, to recruit better, and to take opportunity as well to be able to learn how to interact better with communities that across this country that we have such a wide variety of people in this community that are white, a black, a Muslim, gay, lesbian, you name it. And officers today are much better trained, they're much better equipped, but these issues of our past still haunts us. And so when we have these negative interactions, they oftentimes, and they every time, must be investigated based on that particular incident. And we cannot tie what happened in California or Rochester to DeKalb or to Miami. We have to look at each one of our cases individually. So we still have racial issues in this country that we still have to confront and deal with. But nevertheless, our police officers, white and black and brown and everyone else, they're our front line. They're the ones who are called to the most challenging scenes, if you will, at any given time. They're that part of government that people reach out to and can touch. And when we consider the environment that we're in today, when we look at the fact that police certainly have taken some horrendous hits from our communities at large based on what a few people have done and not based on the majority, but a few, because one thing we cannot do is take the actions of one or two individuals or several individuals, if you will, across this country and say it's reflective of all our police in this country, because it is not. But what we have to do as a profession, we have to continue to make sure that we recruit men and women who want to be guardians in a community, who want to be part of community. We're not occupiers. We come in, we join with our communities, we share in our differences, we get to know each other. And we also are very conscious of the fact that we also must have departments in public safety that reflects the demographics of those communities. That's hugely important. But at the end of the day, Evan, what people want more than anything else, regardless of where they live and who they are, they want to be treated with a sense of respect. And we have to be able to make sure that we provide our men and women in law enforcement with the support that they need in order to do a very difficult job. But we also have to hold ourselves responsible as law enforcement and take accountability when someone goes outside or goes out of bounds. So to your question, yes, we're still challenging not just this community, but America. And you just can't relegate it to Rochester. But across this country, we still got to work through issues. But here's what I am so proud of this mayor and this chief of police chief is the fact that they're working together. They understand the importance of diversity. They work to train their men and women on the importance of procedural justice and being respectful and people feeling that they're being heard by their law enforcement. But that does not mean that we're not going to have challenges out there. Certainly we are. But what makes a community strong is to be able to confront those challenges and to deal with them each case individually. And sometimes that is very hard because these are real emotional issues, and emotional issues that have been with people of color all their lives and generations before them. But we're in a time right now when we have to consider the fact, as diverse as this community is that we have a police department, and I have always had a great deal of admiration for the Rochester police, and still do to this day. And I am confident in the men and women who serve out there every day. And I want to support them. The mayor wants to support them. The community wants to support them. And if by any chance, if someone goes out of bound, and if that's the determination following the investigation, then appropriate action will be taken, whatever that action may happen to be. But in the interim of that, we have to continue to allow ourselves to trust each other, because there are people out there who do harm to other people, and we all want to be safe. And we have to share in that public safety objective together. And that includes communities, and that includes police, regardless of what color you are.
What do you make of the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, Black Lives Matter movement is a movement of its time. It grew out of the whole Michael Brown incident there in Ferguson. And I was very much there at the beginning of all this. They're a movement that have their place in America's history at this particular time and has its voice. And they, as American citizens, have a right to have a voice. And even though I may agree with them on some things and in some things I may not, but at the end of the day, what's really important about that group, they're young people. They're young people that are black. They're young people that are black, white. They're young people who want to say, we want to see something different. And you know what? That has been the greatness of this country, is when movements have come along and have said, hey, we want to see something. We want to experience something different. At the end of all this, we're going to be a better nation because of movements, whether it was women's suffrage, or whether it was the civil rights movement, or whether it was Black Lives Matter. But the whole idea is that we move forward, and we move forward progressively, and we learn from each other. And everyone should have a voice at the table, whether I agree with them or not. So to answer your question, Black Lives Matter is a movement of their time in this 21st century who are challenging all of us to do better. And at the same time, we're also challenging them to take responsibility and help us carry out the mission of public safety and a better government for all of us.
Cedric Alexander comes back to be deputy mayor in an election year, so you can't avoid politics, though our goal is not to make this a political hour. Mm-hmm. That said, I know you've heard some of the criticism of your work when you're a police chief, and so let me at least voice some of that and let you respond to some of what mm-hmm. we've heard in the public sector in the last few weeks here. There was concern that, you know, Operation Law and Order, you go back to 2005 or so, 2004, 2005, was too aggressive, that officers were being told to search cars, search people, look for reasons to do that, that it amounted to a version of stop and frisk, and that stop and frisk has been shown to disproportionately impact communities of color, does not work. And the concern is that by appointing you, Mayor Warren has sort of de facto endorsed that kind of policing. So number one, you go back to that. Was that stop and frisk, and do you regret any of that?
Well, first of all, let me say this. Thank you for asking me publicly that question.
Sure.
Because there have been some false information that is put out there. So let's go back to 2005. And I'll go back to Lyle and Dewey Avenues. During that time, during my tenure as chief, during that particular summer, we had a rash and a number of shootings that was taking place across this city. And the community was outraged. Children had to come in off the street. People couldn't be outside on a hot afternoon enjoying their summer. So very clearly, what I did and the decision that I made is that I asked our tactical teams to come together and put together a plan and go into some of these areas that was frequented with a great deal of shootings and violence. And here's what they did, Evan. They did that. They went in those communities. They paired up. They walked those streets. People came out of their homes. Children came back out to play. And you know what those officers did? They weren't there shaking people down. They weren't there stopping cars arbitrarily and violating people's constitutional rights. We never even used that type of language. But it was a point in time at that time in 2005, 12 years ago, where I had a responsibility as a chief to protect this public and take the men and women in this department and utilize the resources that we had had available to us. And I'm going to tell you something, and you can go back and you can fact check this. There was not ever one internal affairs complaint ever made during that operation, and not one complaint was ever made into City Hall to then Mayor Bill Johnson, because had it been, I'm quite sure I would have heard about it. So that is a total falsification, and it's being politically driven. And if you go out and ask people in this community, are they glad Cedric Alexander is back? There are people that live in those communities that will say yes. And if there's an outcry, or if there had been an outcry, oh, wow, he's coming back. I don't think that's what you've heard and experienced. At least I have not. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it's not what I have experienced. So that was a falsehood. And the falsehood and the person who put that falsehood out there at that particular time was the same person who was begging to jump in with us so that she could report those events, but never, to my knowledge, it reported anything that was unconstitutional during that time. Those men and women in 2005 knew this much about me. Whatever we do, we're going to treat people with respect. We're going to do it constitutionally. But if we have to use force to confront violence, we will. That's what we're trained to do. Because at the end of the day, we want to keep this community safe. People want to be safe. But when you have people in those communities who step forward and say, thank you, we could not sustain that operation over any long period of time because we have other responsibilities. But what we did throughout the course of that, the men who worked on that team at that time, they did an exceptional job, but they did the job with respect and they did it with professionalism. And when you have people who come out to the streets and say, thank you for being here, and certainly we had a couple of people who made statements, oh, why they're here with this show of force and so forth and so on. But let me tell you something. The most important thing we have in our community are the people that we serve. And in public safety anywhere, regardless of where you are, we have an ultimate responsibility to keep people safe. And the community has a responsibility to work with their police department. And no one then or now is going to be treated unconstitutionally. And Chief Simonelli has done an outstanding job. This mayor has done an outstanding job. They have stood with these officers when they have been right, and they've held them accountable when they have been wrong. And I can't think, and you can't ask for any better than that. But I'm going to tell you something, to be a chief in 2005 and to be a chief in 2017, a lot has changed in 12 years. Now, our approach today would have to be a little bit different because times have changed and the temperament of our communities have changed. But at the end of the day, people want to see public safety in their community. They don't want to see crimes. They don't want to be victims.
What's the biggest temperament change that you see?
Well, I think, you know, post-Michael Ferguson.
Michael Brown and Ferguson.
Michael Brown and Ferguson. Post that event, our communities have become much more sensitized to the fact that what we saw there in Ferguson with police officers aiming M4 rifles downrange at American citizens who were peacefully protesting, that's totally unacceptable. And we all had to go back, we had to look at ourselves, and we had to change some of our strategies. But those were American citizens. Now, when people are being violent and dangerous to others, certainly we have to take more stronger action. But quite frankly, we also, what we've learned from that is to be more patient and to change our approach in a way that keeps everyone safe, but at the same time doesn't show us as some occupied army force that's moving into a community as if somehow they're are the enemy. They're not the enemy. They're American people, and they deserve to be respected regardless of where they live and who they are. And that is something that we're going to carry out. We're going to carry out constitutionally in this city. And as long as I have breath in my body, I will always stand by law enforcement in terms of us doing things the right way and doing it constitutionally. And that's one thing that I've always had pride in with Rochester Police Department, and certainly it has had its challenges. Look, when I was chief in DeKalb, we had our challenges there too. We had events there too that created a great deal of pause and concern for us. But what we were able to do there was to work through those issues as police and community, and that's the same thing that you will see here. And I think that's what you have seen demonstrated over the last numbers of years. But there's still work for all of us to do.
All right. Well, before I get back to taking a couple more phone calls, one quick follow-up on that then. I don't want to assume, but I am assuming based on your answer that you do not view what happened in that summer of 2005 as a version of, quote, stop and frisk.
Oh, absolutely not.
And then generally speaking, does stop and frisk work, or is it ineffective and does it disproportionately?
So let me separate those two
things.
And
I am asking generally now. Yeah, I'm not asking
about
specific.
I got it. So let me separate those two things. This was not an operation of stop and frisk.
Okay.
This was an operation of getting into those communities, high visibility, with our tactical units that showed some sense of force because there was a great deal of violence going on at that time. Shootings in the daytime, people afraid to come out on the street. And we did something to stop it. We weren't able to sustain that for a long period of time, but we stopped it long enough so that community could find a sense of balance again. And then what we wrapped around that was some continued patrols of officers going through those areas as frequent as we could.
And by the way, where were the areas in the city we're talking about?
Well, there were a number of them. It was along that time. I think it was Chala Avenue was one. There was another time. It was up around Lyle and Dewey. But I'm going back 12 years.
Sure, yeah.
But we moved through those communities where night after night there was gunfire, there was violence, there were shootings, and we had to do something. And I'm very proud of the work that the men and women did at that time. Now, let's talk about stop and frisk. Let's talk about that. Here's the problem. If you're going to stop and frisk, you need to have reasonable or probable cause. You just cannot stop people based on the fact of the color of their skin or the way that they wear their clothing or they just look whatever. That need to be coupled with something in which you can articulate that raise a level of suspicion that any reasonable person would say, I need to intervene here and ask questions. What has happened to stop and frisk, it has gone unsupervised, and there has been upon too many occasions in too many cities across this country where people's rights have just been unjustly stopped and have been wrongly treated. And that's not acceptable under any regard whatsoever. So police have a very challenging job to do. They have to have their eyes and ears open. They have to pay attention to what's going on in the world and in the environment and in the precincts and the neighborhoods that they work in. But we have to do it constitutionally. And what happens and what has gotten police departments in trouble is that on these stops and frisks, they haven't been able to articulate or record even why they stopped and involved themselves and such. So let's talk about New York second for one moment.
Sure.
New York City for one moment. You can say that New York City was very successful in reducing crime through stop and frisk, right? And Mayor Giuliani will say that, and he prides himself on that. It brought crime down in the city. But here's other piece we learned through the 21st Century Task Force examination we did in this country under President Obama. Yes, it brought crime down, but it also increased discontent in those same communities. Why? Because anybody who happened to be out on the street would get stopped. Innocent people, good people, bad people, for no reason. So what we have to find a balance of is that we have to create an environment in which we constitutionally do our jobs through stop and frisk, right? Through Terry. But at the same time, we also got to be balanced in building that relationship as well. You can't just arbitrarily stop people because they look suspicious. There's got to be some meat on that bone. There's got to be something else in which we can articulate the reason for that stop, right? But at the same time, we have to build relationships in those communities as well. But if we go in there as some kind of occupying force that does not adhere to or respect the constitutional rights of all people, we find ourselves in a great deal of trouble.
All right, let me get back to your phone call. Sam in Rochester next. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes, how you doing, Mr. Alexander? You don't remember me, do you? Reverend King?
Yes, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine, but I'm a little disappointed in you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know you don't want to talk about the numbers of the jobs that the mayor said that she created.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can't trust her with those numbers in which she said that she created the jobs, and I know she didn't, how can I trust her going forward? How can I put my trust in somebody that can't tell me the truth just about it? Just tell me the truth. That's all I'm asking about. I'm not asking you to fudge no numbers.
Yes, sir.
I'm not asking you to take credit for what somebody else hired people. And you said that you have driven through the communities here in Rochester,
mm-hmm.
and that you see people going to work.
He says he sees construction.
What community did you drive through?
I drove through Rochester. But you also have to remember this, Reverend King. I haven't been around here every day as you have. I just walked into this community, and I look around this community for a fresh set of eyes, and I see construction that has come up in this community that was not here before, even in recent years. And that is very promising. And with that promise, you know, when we see buildings we see that are coming up in downtown, we see opportunities that we hear about, whether it's Parcel 2 or Parcel 5. But even beyond that, the construction of new housing and development that is taking place. But we also have to remember that you have a mayor that's only been in office for 3.5 years, sir. And not only that, these issues that we're confronted with socially in this community were here long before she was. And she's taking on the task of resolving those issues. She is certainly interested in developing new jobs. She hasn't told a lie here. I think what has to be clarified, and this is what we've talked about, Evan, you know, maybe being done at a different date, as to those numbers and how those numbers were acquired and how they were looked at and studied. That's in all fairness to everybody. But look, you got a mayor who is honest. You got a mayor who loves this community. And you have a mayor who is committed, who was raised in this community, who have roots in this community, and wants this, like you and I, Reverend King, the very best for this community. So I wouldn't characterize her as being a liar. What I would characterize this as is that we have a community at this very moment. If we look around, there is construction going on. There is opportunities for hope. You being a pastor, you being a clergy, know what is hope? Hope is having faith in the future. And that's the faith we're going to continue to have as we continue to move forward with this. Thank you, sir.
Sam, thank you for the phone call. Let me just clarify one more time here for anybody listening. We focused a lot on police and community issues because that has been an emphasis for Cedric Alexander throughout his career. And he is in day four of the job. And we talked before the program began. And yeah, Cedric said he can't come in here and talk with authority on every single exact statistic. So was I ready to come in and talk about the jobs numbers? Yes. Are we going to do that on a different day with members of the city administration? I certainly hope so. I expect so. And I think that's fair. So that's why we haven't gotten into quite as much detail. I'm going to try to keep it really, really tight here. Stephen in Fairport's been waiting. You got to go quick. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, Cedric, welcome back to Rochester.
Hey, Stephen, how are you? Thank you. Thank you. Great being
I'm
home.
I'm a boater. There are thousands of us out here, and I've got something shocking to tell you.
Yes, sir.
There's no boat launch on the Genesee River that would bring thousands of dollars, new people spending money to downtown Rochester. And it stuns me. I mean, I have a boat.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go through a lock
mm-hmm.
to get to the Genesee River.
Yes, sir.
It makes no sense. You mm-hmm. own the Genesee Valley Park.
Mm-hmm.
It would what would a launch cost to put in a launch and some docks to get boaters, there's thousands of us, to come downtown and spend money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just shocked. Could you look into that? I just don't understand. Genesee River is the lifeblood of Rochester, New York. There used to be a canal that went through it.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we do that again?
All right. Thanks very much,
Steve.
Yeah,
I'd be love to respond to that. Thanks for your call. And having been a former boater myself, growing up in Florida, I certainly do understand the compassion you have about boating. But let me say this. That is a grand idea. And as you were talking, we were taking notes of that. And I'm going to take that back to City Hall with me. But in addition to that as well, I think it'd be important to note that we're already beginning to have conversations as to how we help develop that part of our community and to make it more interesting and more vibrant. Because when you have a waterway coming through your community of any type, I think there's a lot of great ideas that can come out of that as we move forward. And that's part of the vision of this mayor. And I think to hear from our friends outside the city who love this city just as much as we do, it just even just goes further to the point for me how much we're connected and how much we can do to help each other. So thank you for that question, and I'm going to take that back with me, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Alan writes to us and says, Evan, we love having access to leadership locally. Thanks for bringing Cedric on. Are you bringing the other mayoral candidates on? Cedric's not running for mayor. He's deputy mayor.
Yes, thank you very much.
It's a fair question, though, because there's been a lot that has been said this hour. And so the answer is, of course, we've already had, I think, just about every mayoral candidate on. Tony Michikan next week, but the answer is yes, and probably sooner than later, because you can't avoid politics, but we tried to talk about a lot of different things with Cedric Alexander, and I assume as the deputy mayor spends more time on the job, we'll come back and we'll be able to broaden the discussion next time.
Maybe look forward to it.
Maybe talk jobs, policy, a lot more.
Look forward to it.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Nice having you. That's Cedric Alexander, the deputy mayor of the city of Rochester. Short break and much more connections is coming up.